Hi, I'm Amanda Borchel-Dunn. Welcome to the Times of Israel Daily Briefing.
Your update on what's important in Israel, the Middle East, and the Jewish world.
Hi there. Today is Tuesday, September 14th, and I'm Jessica Steinberg. With me today are Times of Israel diplomatic correspondent Lazer Berman and senior analyst Chaviv Rettegor. Glad that you are both here.
Hi, Jessica.
Good morning.
Let's start it with you, Lazer, back from a trip in the U.S., and obviously the news is waiting for you. Prime Minister Naftali Bennett reported on Monday that he had this very important warm meeting with Egyptian President Abdel Fattah el-Sisi in Sharm el-Sheikh, the first in a decade between the two countries' leaders. An Israeli flag was displayed in back of them. Tell us what you know and what you think about it.
Sure. So this meeting was known for a few days beforehand, but was kept secret, and there was instructions not to release any information about it until right before the meeting started. The last time there was an official visit from an Israeli prime minister to Egypt's leader was in 2011, when Netanyahu met Hosni Mubarak in Sharm el-Sheikh, about a month before he was deposed in the Arab Spring uprisings and the whole Tahrir Square protest movement. Now, there were secret meetings, 2018, I could point at, when Netanyahu went to meet Sisi. But this was the first publicly acknowledged official one, and that's significant in many ways. It certainly shows that the Egypt-Israel relationship, and especially the way Sisi, a strongman and autocrat, looks at Israel, is that he understands the Israeli democratic process, and he has to establish close relations with the Israeli leader, whoever that may be, and not just with Netanyahu or any particular leader. Israeli officials and Israeli sources were obviously very optimistic and upbeat, and talked about a deepening, including Bennett talked about this, a deepening expansion of relations into areas which have historically been underdeveloped, to say the least, between the two sides, trade and tourism. Though I should warn that this meeting does not mean there's any end to deep Egyptian anti-Israel feelings amongst the public and amongst civil society. And Sisi did this because he feels secure enough that he can show that this was in Egypt's national security interest, and he can frame it that way, and this is not going to make any problems for him in the domestic sphere. Should we expect any major expansion of business and tourist ties? No, not really. The Egyptian bureaucracy is so Byzantine and difficult to deal with. I don't think any Israeli companies, or many Israeli companies, are going to have an easy time doing business there, more than they do already. And in terms of tourism, I don't expect any massive expansion beyond enabling more Israeli tourists to reach the South Sinai, and which has been going on, and just expanding there. But in terms of anything like we're seeing in the UAE or Morocco, that's not on the table. These Israeli tourists are an important source of foreign currency for Egypt, which has really lost, obviously, its tourism sector with the COVID, the pandemic. So while this is significant and it shows that ties continue to remain strong, at least in the strategic and the security realm, I don't expect any major breakthrough in terms of what we're seeing with other Abraham Accord countries.
I heard on Channel 12 that it was also a message to Hamas, that Bennett was essentially offering a message to Hamas by having this meeting. What are your thoughts about that? Does that make sense?
Well, I think in terms of the Palestinian front, I would look at the Egyptian side. I think that's more significant, in that Egypt is really displaying to the Biden administration, with which it has an uncertain relationship moving forward, that it is indeed crucial to movement on the Palestinian front and to regional stability. And if you remember, at the beginning of the Biden administration, the only attention given to Egypt was over its human rights abuses. And then in the May conflict, it became very clear that Egypt was the main player in terms of bringing both Hamas and Israel to the table. It is the only player that can do that. And that makes it very important. I think the Biden administration now understands that. And it's important for Egypt to continue to show that it is the player that can really bring the two sides together and to promote stability. And yes, of course, Egypt is no fan of the Muslim Brotherhood and is no fan of its branch in Gaza, Hamas. And I say that as an understatement. But of course, it's not going to see eye to eye with Israel entirely on that. But this is certainly important that the two sides are talking, the two leaders are talking publicly about bringing some more stability and bringing some long-term arrangement to the Gaza Strip, even if it's not what Israel expects. We heard Foreign Minister Lapid talk about some economic for security arrangement, which is something that Israeli leaders, including Tzipi Livni, have talked about in the past. We can't expect Hamas to give up its ideology and its quote-unquote resistance for economic gains, but you know, there are some measures that will increase stability that are on the table, and it's important to have Egypt pushing for those as well.
Okay. Chaviv, you got any thoughts on this?
There's a domestic Israeli political angle, which is Bennett doing his best to create, you know, images that track with, you know, Netanyahu's sort of long time and very carefully managed and carefully cultivated image as a world leader and a strategic thinker and a regional figure. And I think Bennett is trying to piece that together and to find ways to visit, you know, neighbors and to have significant meetings. Angela Merkel's visit to Israel was canceled because of the Afghanistan situation. Bennett went to Washington, sat with Biden. Likud immediately tried to take that away from him by insisting that Biden fell asleep in the meeting with him. And so there's this domestic use of all of this that I think is interesting. But you know, it's also obvious and it's also necessary. And maybe we'll talk a little bit after this on about the sort of domestic political fight over the budget and over the Knesset, where some of this is sort of a significant and important backdrop with Bennett trying to sort of claim that gravitas and that validity as prime minister.
Right. No, and Laser, just to ask you, having just obviously come back from Washington with Bennett a couple of weeks ago, and now this meeting with Sisi, how do you see it all? How do you see Bennett? I'm curious about that.
Sure. I agree with Chaviv that let's not forget he has a mandate. He has six mandates in the Knesset right now. He's somehow became prime minister through the dealings of the anti-Netanyahu bloc in the Knesset. And so he doesn't have an especially strong mandate, and it's important that he really crafts that image that Chaviv was talking about. I wouldn't say that the Biden trip was especially successful because he got put off for a day, knowing that the prime minister of Israel would have to spend another day plus stuck in a hotel in his suite. That doesn't exactly exude the image of a first-rate international figure. However, he did get the photo opportunity, and there was gestures from both sides. So there are things to point out from the Biden meeting that Bennett can take home. And this was another important step. But again, it's important that he understands that he has to stop acting like the leader of a party with six seats, and instead act like an Israeli world leader on par with Netanyahu and Begin and Sharon and Ben-Gurion and those. That's the position he's in. He's in it for less than 2 years. He has less than 2 years left in that position, but he really has to step into that role, and hopefully for his people that this is another step in that direction.
That's enlightening. For me, at least.
Like Cool Runnings meets Bull Durham, Designated Hitters is the story of how a team that doesn't even have a baseball stadium made it all the way to the Olympics, and how a ragtag group of dreamers found themselves playing and almost beating the world's best baseball players. Produced by Soul Shop in partnership with the Israel Association of Baseball, join me, Chana Weinberg, and experience the glorious intersection of the American pastime and the Holy Land, wherever you listen to your podcasts.
Chaviv, you mentioned that you're working on this piece about the fight over the Knesset committees. Who is winning?
Yeah, there's a desperately boring, arcane, and very technical and procedural fight in the Knesset about how many members of the coalition and how many members of the opposition are going to be appointed to which Knesset committees. And it is one of those wonderful stories where the very boring procedural thing that for some reason all the Knesset members are deeply invested in and all of Israeli politics right now is stuck over, and the state budget is going to be is dependent on it, when you sift through the procedures and you sift through the technicalities that make everyone sort of yawn, you discover this very powerful and visceral fight between politicians that really reveals a great deal about how Israeli politics gets done. And that's what I'm sort of trying to convey in the piece. Basically, what the story is that we have a very narrow coalition. And we have only the second in Israel's history, parity government, right? A unity government in which supposedly the two halves of Israeli politics, the one half and the other half, both get together to form this unity coalition of opposition and coalition previously are now together. And so this broad-based coalition, it's what happened in 2020 with the Gantz-Netanyahu coalition for a short time until, of course, Netanyahu refused to pass a state budget in order to deny Gantz his turn. And so you had this unity coalition. Now, there is a tradition in the Knesset in which the obviously the coalition is a majority by definition, and the coalition concedes certain committees to the opposition. And it's a very strong, tradition. And that includes the economy committee, the main committee that oversees all the economic regulators, not the finance committee that draws up the budget, but the sort of oversight of the economy committee, and the state control committee, which is the committee of the state ombudsman and all the reports about all the things going wrong in the country, is also held by the opposition. So the opposition has the ability to both keep track of the government, demand from the state comptroller to investigate things the government is doing, and also has some important say over the regulatory regime of the government, even though it is the opposition. That's the tradition, the economy and the state control committee. Gantz and Netanyahu broke that tradition in the beginning of 2020 by holding on to both finance, which is traditionally a coalition committee, and necessarily a coalition committee, otherwise a coalition can't pass a state budget, and also holding on to the economy committee. And their reasoning was, you know, we are the opposition and the coalition together in a unity government, so we can control all of these committees. Well, that was a bad precedent to set, because now you have a coalition that is a parity government, technically, but is not, emphatically not, a broad-based unity coalition the way the Gantz-Netanyahu government claimed to be. Even then it wasn't, right? Because for Gantz to join Netanyahu, he lost most of the center-left. And so even with less excuse, this coalition is holding on to the economy committee, to a whole series of important committees that the opposition used to have. And not only that, instead, because it's made up of eight different parties, this coalition, some of them very small, including the party that holds the prime minister's seat, as Laser said, very small. It needs more wiggle room in the finance committee to pass a budget without losing one of its own members, an Arab party member, a right-wing party angry at the left-wing parties, a left-winger angry at the right-wing parties in their own coalition. So they gave themselves in the Knesset committees that assignments that they drew up, the coalition gave themselves a majority of two seats in the finance committee instead of the traditional one. Now, what that means, getting away from the procedure now and into the part that really matters, is that this coalition is very narrow, very fragile, and so has essentially pushed the opposition out of power in all of the major Knesset roles that the opposition would need to rein in the government. Now, the coalition's excuse, and it is a good excuse, it is probably a correct excuse, is that Likud is trying to play the spoiler regardless of policy, and it is trying to play a spoiler that will hurt the country desperately. For example, Likud is actively trying to make sure the coalition cannot pass a budget. Why does it want to make sure the coalition can't pass a state budget? For last time, right, this was Likud's entire 2020 that had no state budget. All of 2021 has no state budget. Likud would like this government to also fail to pass a state budget, despite the really significant harm to the Israeli economy, to a lot of Israelis, because then by November, this Knesset dissolves and we go to elections and Likud hopes to take power. So Likud wants another year in which Israel has no budget. And the coalition, to prevent that from happening, needs to push Likud out of any capacity to stop the budget going through by essentially sidelining them in the Knesset committees. Long story short, it's a very technical, dry procedural battle, but it has seen some language that you would not believe. Likud said publicly, we don't believe that the High Court which is too powerful in Likud's view, should intervene in the inner workings of the Knesset. Except on this, which Likud then, several members of Likud, not the party, but several members of Likud, went to the High Court and said, how can you let them push us out of these positions? This is an old Knesset tradition. This is a steamrolling, you know, democracy, and there's no democracy in the Knesset. And so the High Court has now been dragged into this whole issue and is demanding answers from both sides. Everyone is posturing. So the Knesset is, even though it's the high holidays, even though there's a recess, the Knesset is very much percolating and bubbling, and there's a lot of anger and a lot of frustration, and we're probably heading into something of a constitutional crisis.
Chaviv, forget the book. I think you should write a dramedy about the budget debates.
Yeah.
Go for it. I thank both of you for being with us today on Tuesday. Happy writing. Hope you have good stories coming your way. And to our listeners, thanks for being with us. We'll be back tomorrow.
Thanks, Jessica.
Thank you. Thanks, Jessica.
Hi, it's Sarah Tuttle Singer from the Times of Israel. Come join our community and support fast and fair independent journalism. You can sign up with the link at the bottom of every single article on the site.
Thanks for listening to the Times of Israel's Daily Briefing. A special thanks to our producer, Raoul Woodliff. I'm Amanda Borshaldan.
You can find us daily wherever you get your podcasts.
And on our mothership, thetimesofisrael.com.